In the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, all of this working from home seemed so novel and weird. We were all chattering about crappy Zoom connections, trying to keep our cat or our kids from barging in on a Zoom meeting. And we were full of advice about how to establish a routine or set up a home office. And now, those of us who can work from home, we're all just doing it, but wondering not just when we go back to the office, but if we should. The thing is, we've been thinking about this, about telecommuting, for years now, years. In fact, telecommuting as a thing was an invention, something dreamed up by a man named Jack Nils,
who saw the world as being full of problems that can be solved with the right application of intelligence.
This is Cal Newport. He studies computer science, and he's been researching our various attempts over the years to try and work from home. And that's when he came across the story of Jack Nils.
This is someone who worked on communication systems for space probes. He was on some of the committees that were briefing Lyndon Johnson on the space program, so almost like a literal rocket scientist.
Good morning, Los Angeles. Traffic on the 405 already at a standstill. Good luck if you're going that way.
In the 1970s, he gets obsessed with this problem of traffic congestion. This is really the era where you began to see freeways beginning to become gridlocked. So he looks at this problem with an engineer's hat, and he says, okay, I figured it out. The issue is that we have one big office for a company that's in the middle of the city, and everyone lives outside the city, and they're all driving into the middle of the city to go to this one big office. That's why we have traffic congestion. There's got to be a better way. And so his better way was, why don't we build small satellite offices all around the suburbs of the city? You could do a short drive to whichever one was closer, but you could also walk, bike, no long commute, no congestion from everyone going to the same place. And through the use of couriers and terminal connections to central mainframes, he sort of figured it out. And so we could probably keep these satellite offices sufficiently synchronized that it would still work more or less the same. He coined the term telecommute and telework. It was in that moment that we really had some of the first inklings that maybe office-style work did not require everyone to be in the same office. I think the fact that he was a communication engineer for space probes gave him this insight. He'd spent a career working on how to modulate signals to send the probes that were across the solar system.
3, 2, 1.
In someone's mind like that, people should be able to communicate in the same company, let's say, across downtown Los Angeles.
Highs today in the upper 90s. Keep that AC cranked and happy commuter.
How do people react?
So the idea of the satellite offices wasn't practical. It was too expensive to build that many offices. The complexity of trying to synchronize them with couriers and mainframe computers, that didn't really pan out. But it turned out that it didn't need to.
You're looking at a small portable computer called the IBM 5100. It's helping a lot of different people do their work more productively.
Managing real estate investments entails many difficult decisions.
Everything moved onto the PC. So suddenly, if you were an office worker, you had a general purpose computer on your desk and you did your work on this computer. And then we networked those computers. Now, once that shift happened, well, we don't really need satellite offices anymore. We could just put one of these computers in your home office.
Using an Apple II is very easy. The only hard part is getting your kid away from it.
It is as if this light bulb went off in companies worldwide where they started thinking, hey, wait a second, maybe this telecommute, telework idea might actually become feasible.
Google just making a major announcement asking employees to work from home because of the virus.
Working from home
permanently is to become a reality for employees of the social media giant Twitter.
And there is a sense, and there is certainly a question being asked about whether this is the new normal.
It seems like now we're all being forced to be part of this experimental phase right now, and this moment could maybe really tell us whether we're going to be able to pull this off.
We really got rid of every last obvious pragmatic obstacle to remote work, probably by around 2007, 2008. And at that point, we forget there was actually a really huge push towards telework, and a lot of companies began to move a lot of their employees either predominantly remote or majority time remote. So we actually tried this out, but then we pulled that back. So it's almost like right now we are returning to what we tried before and fell short on, and are saying, I hope we can get it right this time, because this time we don't have a choice. Last time we pulled back, this time we don't know how to pull back. So there's a little bit of a tension in our current moment because it's not completely novel. And we're wondering if we're going to get a different outcome this time.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. And that's what the show is about today. Will we get a different outcome this time? Has this forced experiment of remote work worked? Can we do this? And even if we can, should we? Cleaner air and less congested roadways, that's great. But is it a good trade-off for the lack of physical proximity and the social advantages of working alongside someone for real? Back to Cal Newport. He's a professor of computer science at Georgetown University. And his own interest in this subject makes sense because it turns out his mom was one of the very first real remote workers.
So in the 1980s, my mom was a COBOL programmer, and she worked on the big Series 7 IBM mainframes at the Houston Chronicle. And at some point, essentially the commute became, this was Jack Mills's problem, the commute was becoming prohibitive. We had four kids at that point. She was thinking about moving on. She was very good. They did not want her to move on. So they say, I think we can maybe figure this out. So they brought her a monochrome screen PC, a very early model PC. There was a telephone modem that made the squelches. We all remember the old modem. And it would connect to the mainframe so that she could actually write her code from home. But this was at the very early, at the edge of that envelope of remote work being possible, because what she remembers is you would actually watch the screen fill line by line.
Wow.
So you would say, I'm going to request a screen of code. You would watch it fill line by line. She estimated there was probably multiple hours each day lost to just transmitting information back and forth. She would go and do laundry or read a book and come back. You know, it wasn't at all efficient, but I think the fact that I remember seeing that as a child is what sparked me to this idea. You know, there's probably a really long history to this idea that goes beyond just what we're used to from recent years, like jumping on Zoom, having email. That's what sparked my interest in the notion that there's probably actually a history here that goes much farther back. And so it's a coincidence that my mom happened to be a part of that history, but I'm glad she was, because it turned me on to the story.
When does this idea of working from home first emerge? Tell us what you have found in that history.
Well, the idea of this being widespread and not a one-off idea like when my mom's situation, where it was like sort of an extreme circumstance, I think that really hit home once you began to get network computers in the office and home internet connections. So really, once you're talking about the late 1990s, you begin to see a convergence of some of these technologies that really makes it possible. In the late 1990s, you have many more people that have home internet connections. And you have almost everyone in the office context now fully familiar working with network PCs. And the cost of these PCs was such that more and more people had them at their home. And you bring together those elements, and suddenly it became possible. You could word process, you could send emails, you could put things on file share servers and pull things from file share servers. So by the late 90s, this became something that seemed widely possible.
So you mentioned in your writing that by about 2004 or so, if you look at the momentum toward working from home, it's all headed that way. Like we're headed towards some big maybe even cultural change. There's certainly the technology that's there. And it seemed like, as you put it in your article, we're on the brink of a profound shift.
Yeah, the final piece of the puzzle fell into place, it seemed, in that first decade of the 2000s. So once we had home computers and they were networked and we were used to it and we could log into the same systems from home that we did at the office, once we had all of that, the final missing piece was communication. As we were still limited then to email or maybe calling someone up one-on-one on the phone. And so it was the advent of Skype really that put that final piece into place, because Skype came along and said, we're going to take advantage of your home broadband. So now you can do essentially free or very cheap calls with people in your office or with clients. And then Skype said, you know what, we can do conference calls, because once you have voice over IP, that's not more difficult. So now you could do conference calls without having to have fancy equipment. Then they added video conference calls. So now you can have a meeting. You can go into a meeting like we're used to doing today, of course. You can see other people on the screen. You can see them in video. It's synced with audio. Obviously, lots of other companies like Zoom, like WebEx came along after that and invented competing products. But that was the final piece of the puzzle. So now you could replicate on your desk at home literally every tool you had at your desk at the office, because it's all on the network computer. And you could replicate group conversations and meetings without having to be in the physical office. All that was together by around 2005 to 2007. So you get to about 2007, it felt like we had cracked a code.
Yeah. And then what happens? By 2013, it seems like there was just all this progress, all this momentum just kind of grinds to a halt.
The turning point seems to be when Marissa Mayer, the newly appointed CEO of Yahoo, who had been called in to turn around Yahoo, directed her HR department to put out this now infamous all hands memo that said, no more remote work. Right? We're not doing that anymore. You have to come back to the office. We need to be here in the office if we're going to turn this company around. And it was almost like the dam broke, because you look at 2013, a lot of other major companies started following suit. You start to see HP, Best Buy, various companies saying, yeah, we're going to cut back on a lot of this. We want people back in the office. This is also the period where you began to see the lionizing of these over-the-top corporate campuses, mm-hmm. like at Google.
The cold cereal and candy drawers and the climbing walls and stuff like that.
And the dry cleaning. Yeah. And you know, I found in my research that around this time they were promoting, they had these consultants, basically life consultants that could take tasks unrelated to your work, like planning a birthday party or something like that, take it off your hands so you could stay longer at the office. Like, don't worry, we'll find your Halloween costumes. We'll plan this dinner party. These are the examples they gave in the sort of exuberant articles of that period. Mm. So everything shifted. Now the new vogue became, look at how great our campus is. Look at how much time our employees can spend on our campus. Work from home didn't go away, but the idea of the fully remote worker became much more rare. And instead we got what they would call flexible work arrangements, where maybe one day a week, 1.5 days a week, you might work from home. You might have to take a pay cut to do that. Even if you didn't, this was offered almost like a perk. Like, yeah, it's okay, but we might pull that back if we don't like it. And so it became like a benefit for the employee, as opposed to how it used to be seen, which was going to be something that was going to revolutionize work and be incredibly profitable for the employer as well.
Hmm. So where are we today? And go back a few months before we were all forced to go home from a pandemic. Like remote work, you say in your article, where we are now is it's very much the exception rather than the norm.
Yeah, and it depends on how you calculate these numbers. But if you look at a percentage of the entire U.S. workforce, it's somewhere around 3% that work remotely 50% or more of their time. Now, of course, there's a big sectors of the U.S. workforce in which working remotely doesn't make sense in industrial applications, et cetera. But still, it's a very small number. And essentially, this is what started happening around 2013, is we retrenched and retreated. And remote work became, again, like a benefit. You might be able to do some remote work as long as we deign to allow you. But you should know that this is like having extra vacation days.
Yeah,
it's like something you should be happy about. Even more insidiously, the technology that made remote work possible, that didn't go away. It got repurposed And now employers notice, like, wait a second, I still want you coming to the office, right? I want you here. But after the work hours, hey, we have all this nice technology. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of expect you to do things in the evening. I can expect you to do things in the morning. I can expect you to do things over the weekend because, you know, we did go through all this effort to replicate everything you need to do work at home. So why don't you do a little bit more work at home as well? And so it ended up being almost the exact opposite of what Jack Nihlas hoped for.
Yeah.
We still work in the office and we work at home. And that combination just made us more sort of exhausted and overwhelmed than before.
His plan backfired. You say now we work everywhere.
Anyone who's been answering emails at 10 o'clock p.m. on a Saturday knows that this was the, we can think of this as the perverted sort of version of the original dream.
So give us a sense, if you would, Professor, and I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of numbers. Maybe we don't have them yet, but just for comparison purposes, what about now? If you were to guess, what percentage is out there right now, those that can? What percentage are working from home remotely because they just have to, given where we are?
No, it's a hard thing to measure because you have to break out what industries that you're talking about. Yeah. But, you know, one thing I saw a pretty interesting survey coming out of the Gartner Research Group, and they were surveying CEOs or CFOs, so C-suite executives from this large panel of what we would think of as sort of traditional type of office-bound companies. And it was a significant majority of them planned to make remote work a long-term feature of their arrangement, significant remote work, a long-term feature of their arrangement, even after the COVID pandemic passed. So if we have a significant majority of these companies saying that they're going to maintain it, then there must be an even larger percentage of these traditional office-bound companies that are doing it right now. So I think almost every knowledge worker who can is remote working right now, which is a pretty remarkable situation that we find ourselves in.
One of the things that you explore in the article I wanted to ask you about, and that is why it is that it takes us so long to adapt to new ideas or new technology. And one of the things you mentioned in the piece is the work of a Stanford economist, Paul David. And he used this model from the past of when we were switching between – when we were switching from steam to electric power about 100 years ago. He uses that as the model to sort of talk about how it is that society adapts or takes forever, it seems, to adapt to technology. Talk a little bit about that because it does seem to be a lesson about why we don't seem to take it up right away.
So economists are often surprised when they look back historically and find out how long it took for the widespread adoption of electrical motive power in industrial factories in the US. Because when you look back retrospectively, it makes so much more sense. And an electric factory is way more efficient and way more flexible and adaptive than a factory in which you have a giant steam engine, which is what they were doing before. You would have a giant coreless reciprocating steam engine that would turn a massive overhead crank that ran the entire length of your reinforced factory. You had to have a big, heavy reinforced factory to hold the steam engine. And then you'd have all these leather belts coming off of this big central shaft that would spray lubrication oil everywhere as it spun. And these leather belts would come down from this giant overhead shaft that would connect to all these other different types of machinery. And you had people literally shoveling coal that was being delivered. I mean, the whole thing seems hopelessly old-fashioned as compared to a factory where I have a silent electrical motor and it just runs my piece of equipment, and I can have big windows and skylights. We don't need heavy reinforced walls to hold all the equipment. Everything seems better in an electric factory, but it took decades. After the electric dynamo became widely available, it took decades before we actually saw its wide scale adoption. And so Paul David wanted to understand, you know, what was the obstacles? Why did it take us so long? And his conclusion was, this is somewhat normal. It often takes us longer than we think to actually adopt technologies that end up being quite transformative.
What is it about us It's inertia, you say, is part of the problem.
Inertia and innovation turned out to be the two sides of the same coin of sort of technical obstructionism. So the inertia aspect, you have to remember, let's look back at the factory example. They had invested a lot of money to build these factories that were centered on one giant motive force with these overhead central staffs and all those belts. It would have been very expensive to go and rip that out and try something different. So what a lot of people did instead who were experimenting with electricity is they took what they knew and they tried to graft the old onto it. So they would get the giant reciprocating coilless steam engine. They would take that out and they put in a giant dynamo electrical generator, a huge one like the ones they would use in the central power stations, like Edison's original central power station that was meant to power 200 houses worth of light bulbs. So like, we'll just take out the engine, put in this giant electrical dynamo, hook it up to a giant electrical motor, and then just hook that up to the central shaft. So we'll take what we know and just graft the new technology onto it. But that's not that exciting of a proposition because, yeah, we don't have to shovel coal, but we also now have to fix this dynamo and this engine. The electrical components are a little bit complicated to fix, and it was sort of a wash, and let's just stick with what we know. So the inertia of this is the way we did it, and not being willing at first to drastically change that, but to try to graft new technologies onto the old way, that was a problem. And then the second problem David points out is that there was many small innovations that were required to actually make this work well. And if you don't have those small innovations in place, the things you don't think about at first, when you just think, hey, electricity is cheap, it's going to innovate industrial manufacturing. But these small innovations you don't think about at first, those are the key to making it work. And in this case, for example, eventually they realized you had to have small motors on every piece of machinery. That's much better than one giant motor. That's a natural leap, but to actually make that work, there's complicated problems of variable electrical distribution you have to solve. Because now you have a variable draw. If 10 people at this corner of the factory turn on their equipment, that's going to draw a lot more power suddenly. And then if they turn it off, that power demand is going to drop. And there was actual electrical engineering innovations that were required. So you put together that inertia of the old way and the need for new innovations, and that actually can slow you down quite a bit, even if the ultimate reward is going to end up being quite big for making the shift.
So where we are now, you've said we're basically in this electric dynamo phase of the remote work era, in the sense that we have the technology, we've got all the pieces in place, we just haven't figured out how to graft it into our own sort of culture and our systems, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's a helpful analogy, because I think of that early exuberant period as the early attempts to just put in the giant dynamos to replace the big steam engines. We tried at first to just graft remote work technology onto exactly the way we were used to working. So we say, well, just take the same computer, put it on your desk. Okay, we can't meet in a meeting room, but we can do it on a Zoom call. Same idea, right? Because we can see each other and talk. And we'll just change nothing except for the fact that the same activities are now happening remotely. We tried to just graft it on the new technology, just graft it onto the way we were working. And all of the little minor hiccups got in the way and obstructed us. I mean, it turns out that there are subtleties you get from being in the office. There's ways we work in the office that don't quite work when we're at home. The innovations are going to be required, small innovations, but many of them, to make this new arrangement work. And so a lot of the proverbial factory owners in this analogy just went back to steam. This is Marissa Myers saying, look, this isn't working. Let's just go back to what we know. Today, when we're all being forced to do remote work, it's like this remarkable experiment, as if someone had come back in the early 20th century and had mandated by law, steam can no longer be used. Figure it out. So it's like we're trying to accelerate this phase of getting past inertia, getting past innovation, because we're all being forced to this outcome. You have to figure out how to make this new technology work. And so the optimistic take is, hopefully with this forcing function, we can actually quite accelerate what is typically a long process of figuring out how to make a fundamental new technology work.
So, Professor, let's talk about the challenges, I guess, that we have to figure out. One of the things you mentioned is that we need to find out how we deal with the importance of face-to-face interaction. And the Yahoo memo that you mentioned, it pointed out that a successful workplace happens where there are and here's how you put it, interactions and experiences that are only possible in the office, like hallway and cafeteria discussions and meeting new people and impromptu team meetings. All of that stuff is good. It helps people engage and work as a team. It helps them innovate, those kinds of things. So talk a little bit about that, because I don't know how you replace that.
Well, this is one of the big stumbling blocks to remote work, and one of the things that the original promoters of this movement underestimated, which was the importance of actual in-person interaction with people. It has these many, almost intangible benefits that add up to something really significant. Now, some of these are actually quite subtle. So, for example, you can read the face and body language of someone that you see in the hallway. And you can say as a manager, that person seems overworked, right? They seem stressed out. I just hear the timbre of his voice. I'm not going to put some extra tasks on his plate right now. When you go remote, everything's just abstract. You're an email address. You're ASCII characters on a screen. Mm-hmm. People are just trying to get things off their mm-hmm. plate. And you can end up drastically overloading people. It turns out that there is a ton of efficiency that's gained by the 5-minute conversation. And we took for granted that if you take these numerous small impromptu 5-minute interactions, you know, let me stop in your office at the end of a meeting. If you try to take all those interactions and instead say, let's spread them out over back and forth email messages, you increase your email quantity by whatever, 2x, 3x, and it goes from being a lot to being overwhelming. So these type of things really matter. And then there's just a psychological health aspect of it.
Yeah.
For a lot of adults, the office is where they do their primary person-to-person interaction. And of course, when you take that away, things become pretty lonely. You can become pretty isolated. So we underestimated all the value we got out of actually being able to see a human in the same physical space.
There's this idea that you write about that I find really interesting. And you mention how when you're in person, when you're face-to-face with someone, that the social costs of that give and take of a working relationship get amplified. And it creates this, as you describe it, this friction. And this friction is a good thing in this circumstance. In a remote workplace, it would be easy to overload a colleague with work. But when you're face-to-face, when you have to actually be in person with someone, that friction there keeps you from piling it on. But just talk a little bit about that part, because I found this really interesting.
And this is an idea I've been working on for a while, even beyond the context of this article, is this notion that knowledge work right now is quite haphazard. In many knowledge work organizations, there's very little in the place of processes. There's very little in the way of optimization. How should work unfold? How should we identify a task? How should we assign and review and execute tasks? A lot of that is sort of left up to the individual. It's chaotic. It's haphazard. And one of the things we didn't realize as we were contemplating remote work, the degree to which things like this interpersonal friction helped kind of keep this whole otherwise unstable system barely in check. We underestimated the degree to which these subtle interpersonal forces that unfold when you're actually together in an office, we're keeping this whole otherwise unstable system that's quite haphazard and quite unoptimized, keeping the whole thing in some sort of equilibrium, keeps the wheels from spinning off.
Yeah.
And so when we shift completely remote and we get rid of all these subtle factors, the social capital involved with asking someone to do something, the ability to see how overloaded someone is, when we take that away, things fly off the rails. And suddenly you find people completely overworked and wondering what changed between now and 4 months ago. They say, I'm not doing business trips. I'm not traveling anymore. And yet I seem to have more work than ever before. It's in an unstructured workplace. There is a lot of implicit structuring that happens with physical interaction.
What's the main obstacle standing in the way of all of this beyond the inertia part and the other thing? One of the things you mentioned is managers. Bosses are just reluctant for various reasons.
Well, this has to be one of the forces as well. Just the notion that, you know, if you are Marissa Meyer or whoever, and you don't actually have your employees in the office, that is in some sense a diminishment of your power or influence. Because, you know, they're not there for you to watch to make sure they're working. They're not there to see your sort of demonstration of power. So there is a power dynamic that goes on with remote work, a power dynamic that shifts. But one of the points I was arguing is that when I was looking into this article, I found that a lot of people I talked to informally assumed that this power dynamic explanation was maybe primary. But like, yeah, mainly bosses don't like remote work. It kind of diminishes the power dynamic. And I think the reality is way more interesting and complicated, that work itself doesn't work when you go remote if you don't do a lot of effort to try to set it up for it.
Yeah. That's interesting. That the idea is it's just the bosses, they want to keep their eye on us, when in fact a lot of us, whether we even outwardly say it or not, like some of the social values that are there at a workplace, the importance of the interaction, the social pleasures and advantages of office life, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot practical that happens. There's a lot good that happens. So there's the practical aspects of helping to keep work more balanced and actually unfolding. There's the efficiencies of in-person interaction. And there's those psychological satisfactions of, I go to this place, and when I'm there, I'm working, and I'm around other people, and I'm interacting with other humans, and it feels good, and I have purpose there. And then when I come home, there's clear separation because I've left that office, I've got home, and there's all of those advantages we lose as well. So yeah, the whole picture is much richer than I guess the cynical assessment, which would have just been, I think bosses don't like it when they can't keep an eye on you.
Right. You raised the possibility that I found intriguing. You don't make too much of it, and we don't need to go into it too much, but you do talk about the idea that there may be some biological reality at play here, that we may have evolved some kind of, as you put it in the piece, some instinctual excitement at working side by side.
I mean, we're undoubtedly a social species. There's huge elements of our neural hardware dedicated to managing social interaction. Our ability to work in small tribes to solve problems like hunting a mammoth or what have you. All this is really important to our species' success. So it's an interesting evolutionary psychological hypothesis that we get a lot more satisfaction out of literally being with people as we accomplish something versus maybe seeing a congratulatory emoji on a Slack channel. Even if it's the same thing being accomplished, even if it's the same group of people accomplishing them, there's just too much of our Paleolithic neural hardware that doesn't know what an emoji is. All it knows is it doesn't see any tribe members nearby, and so doesn't quite feel that same sense of deeply human satisfaction.
Cal Newport, you can find a link to his New Yorker article, Why Remote Work is So Hard and How It Can Be Fixed, on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Radio helps you stay informed, entertained, and connected with your community, and so does your smart speaker, because your smart speaker is also a radio. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home. Never miss a minute.
Stay connected to your community with NPR Utah. Tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking this question. Should we go back to the office? COVID-19 has forced office workers into this experiment of remote work, and we're talking about whether we can or should keep it up. Cal Newport is our guest. He's a professor of computer science at Georgetown, and he has an article in The New Yorker we've been talking about, Why Remote Work is So Hard and How It Can Be Fixed.
Well, something that's interesting from Darwin history is that at his estate that was right outside of London, his family estate, he had this path built, and he called it the sand walk because he paved it in sand, and he laid it out himself to go past the most scenic parts of his property. And doing circuits on the sand walk was a big part of him preparing his mind to think deeply. So he would do a set number of circuits, and the lore is he didn't want to waste mental resources counting, okay, this is circuit five, circuit six. So he'd put rocks at the beginning of his circuits and kick one off the path every time he passed. And then when there was no rocks left, he knew that it was time to move on. And so he could completely think during his circuits. But there's something generalizable in this story, which is that when it comes to preparing your mind to do hard cognitive things, some notion of a warm-up seems to be useful. That's what Darden was doing on his path. Well, for a lot of traditional office workers, you get that warm-up in the ritual of your commute.
Yeah.
So it's another thing that we were taking for granted, but getting to your car, doing the drive, maybe you're listening to something, as you get closer to the office, you stop, you get to the office, you go up the elevators, you go and get your coffee from the communal kitchen, you make it into your office, you turn on the lights. That for a lot of people is not unlike Darwin's circuits on his sand path, his sand walk at his estate. It's a ritual that helps your mind leave the world of the domestic and transform to the world of the professional, which if you make a living with your brain, like all knowledge workers do, that is a really important transition. So it's something that we lost when we temporarily got rid of commutes for remote work. But it's something I mentioned in the article that you can insert back. So you can't commute to an office, but you can do something like Darwin's walk through your neighborhood, same path, same time every day, that these type of rituals can really help get your mind ready to do the type of thinking you need to do to succeed in your job.
Another idea you mentioned is consolidate your appointments into a given half of the day. That could help.
Yeah, you could have a Zoom half of your day and a non-Zoom half of your day. Because one of, again, the issues that happened as we spiraled into sudden remote work, we started doing a lot more meetings on Zoom or WebEx or whatever technology we use, because we lost the ability to grab people. We lost the ability to stop by your office. But if you're in a meeting every hour, if you have to jump to a meeting with only 10-minute break in between, no work actually gets done. And so a simple heuristic can save you here. We do our meetings after 1. We do non-meeting time before 1. And now you suddenly can regain that space you need to actually work on the things that you then discuss in the meetings.
What's time blocking? I liked this idea.
I'm a big proponent of this time management strategy called time blocking, which says don't run your day off of an inbox and a to-do list, right? So don't just have like a list of things to deal with and see how many you do. Instead, look at your hours and say, what do I want to do during specific times? So you actually give your work specific time blocks in which you're going to do it. So you say, from 8 to 9:30, I'm doing this. From 9:30 to 10:30, I have this meeting. From 10 to 10:30, I'm going to check on this. And you actually block off your time and assign work to it. Now, this is a productivity hack that can gain you quite a bit of effectiveness, because when you actually work with the time you have and make an optimal plan, you get a lot more done than if you instead just say, I want to generally try to be as productive as possible during working hours. And in a time where we've lost a lot of our structures around our workday, because we're just at home, and then at some point we're kind of working at home, and at some point we're not, time blocking is a great way to actually put up some scaffolding. And when you put up that scaffolding, you can actually build things quite a bit faster.
Benjamin Franklin did it. It seemed to work for him.
He did it. Peter Drucker, in one of the very original business productivity books, The Effective Executive, made that exact claim. He says, this is something I noticed about executives. They control their time. And so, yeah, maybe now is the time for this particular hack to leave the realm of productivity nerds like myself and become a little bit more mainstream.
But you also point out in your writing that personal productivity, you say, only will get you so far, that we need to create structures in organizations to figure this out too. Let's talk a little bit about that. How can the institutions themselves, how can they rethink how meetings work and how the structure is?
Well, one of the things that became clear when I was working on this article is that there is a particular sector of office workers that has had a lot of success going remote, that before we had the coronavirus lockdown had very large companies, 700 more employee style companies worldwide that have no offices and have had no problem with it. So there is one sector where we seem to have figured out how to do remote work, and that's software development. So you look closer and say, well, what is it about software development that allows them to successfully be remote in the way that they are? And my argument is that a big part of that answer is that they have very organized processes for how work unfolds in their companies. It's not like normal office work where it's like, hey, you got an inbox and you got a lot of meeting invites coming in and you just rock and roll, right? Not in software development. Almost all these firms use what are known as agile software development methodologies, where there's going to be a board. And on this board, there's going to be a card for everything that needs to be worked on. And the cards are going to be in a column that says, here's its current status. And the card's going to be labeled with, here's who is currently working on this. And every day, your team is going to meet real briefly. And they say, who's working on what? What's in your way? What do you need from everyone else? Go at it.
Yeah.
Because they're so organized, they did not have to rely on all of these informal heuristics and controls we get from being in the same office, from being able to see if someone looks overloaded. They use the quick meetings to kind of gain some efficiency. They use the social capital to insert friction. None of this is relevant if you have these really organized structures, and they had no problem going remote. So the organizations themselves need to overhaul the actual processes by which work happens if you want remote work to succeed. And this is something that individuals can't do on themselves. You can't have individuals making these changes and hope that it all adds up to a better way of running. No amount of clever software programmers working on time blocking and good to-do lists are going to come up with an agile methodology being implemented at the organizational level.
So, Professor, what does the future look like? Because you go through this a bit in the article. You mentioned that there will be fewer pre-assigned offices, for example. And this was interesting. You say smaller cities could grow. Larger cities could see decreased housing costs. There could be a lot more variety in these kind of work arrangements. So the future looks really – I don't know. That looks kind of cool.
Yeah, the best estimate seems to be we're going to end up in a hybrid place where there are a lot of people who still work in offices, but a lot of people who just don't work in offices anymore. It's going to be rare that you have a meeting in a lot of these industries in which you're not going to have at least some participants joining remotely. So having permanent remote workers on your payroll is going to become something that's going to be normalized. And that is going to have these effects. You're not going to need offices that are as big. Yeah. Because you don't have as many workers there. Maybe you don't have assigned desks anymore because even the workers who do come there don't come there every day. Because of this, we're going to see this geographic inequities begin to shift a little bit. Mm. Now, suddenly, if you're Bozeman or Asheville or Santa Fe or San Luis Obispo, somewhere that maybe has a lot to offer in terms of quality of life, but is only just missing a hub of really large companies, now you can have remote workers moving there and bringing their income with them and therefore bringing their spending with them. So you begin to see more of the capital generated by these companies distribute itself geographically slightly more. And so I think that's what we're in for, is not a complete revolution, not a Jack Nils sort of there are no central offices anymore, but also not a return to everyone is in the crowded office again.
But how do you solve those social questions we talked about earlier? And this is how you put it in your article. There's probably no way for workplaces to Zoom themselves to the same levels of closeness and cohesion generated in a shared office. So what do we do about that?
We might see different categories of work relationships arise. This is one of the things I talked about in the article. Mm-hmm. You might have at a given company a core of people who work at the headquarters, have that social cohesion, and probably will actually gain career advantages from that. Other people may shift. Instead of just being a remote employee, but otherwise of the same status, you may see more setups like the alliances that were proposed in a book that Reid Hoffman, Ben Casnocha, and Chris Yeh published back in 2014, where they predicted we're going to see more in the future of people setting up knowledge workers, skilled knowledge workers setting up tours of duty, sort of tours of duty alliances with companies where they say, I'll be here remotely for 2 years and I'm working on this. And you do it. And for 2 years, you're working for them and you're working on this one project. And then maybe after that, you say, should we do another tour of duty here? I don't know. Maybe I'll work for that company. Because it doesn't really matter physically. I'm in Santa Fe. I have my land. I'm going on my mountain biking trips, and maybe I'm shifting from tour to duties, and I'm not as cohesively integrated into these companies as the people who are actually in the office. So we might see various categories of remote work relationships where, you know, not everyone's going to have the social cohesion, so they change their relationship with these companies. Other people want it. You're young, you're healthy, you want to live in the city. You say, I'm going to be there, I'm going to be in the office, and maybe I'm going to be on more of a fast track for the executive class. There might be a lot of unforeseen consequences of this, but these are the type of innovations or changes we might expect to see in the years ahead.
I don't want to force you into taking a side, but if you were to weigh it all out, which would you say is better for us as human beings, being in an office or being home?
I think I am voting that the hybrid remote future, if done right, is going to be better. And I think it's going to be for a really clear reason. In order to make industry work, when you have, let's say, 30% of your staff remote, you're going to have to solve these fundamental questions of how do we work as knowledge workers? All these inefficiencies, this haphazardness, this ad hoc nature of work, we've gotten away from it so far by using all these informal in-person heuristics. Once we can't do this, we're going to have to innovate. We're all going to have to become like software developers. That is, we're all going to have to start thinking, what's the right way to actually do this work? And I think that is going to make the experience of work incredibly more sustainable and satisfying for the average knowledge worker. I don't think we realize the degree to which we're making ourselves miserable with this ad hoc, haphazard approach to work, in which we're just drowning in email and Slack, and no one can keep up with anything, and you're overloaded, and you're not overloaded, and there's all these boxes of messages filling every time you're away from your office, and you're stressed about it. The way we're working today, I don't think is sustainable. This could be a forcing function to fix that. If you fix that problem, then not having social interactions in the office, that's no longer an issue for productivity. And now how do we solve the other problem? But I need it for sort of psychological satisfaction. Well, that can also be replaced in your life by other types of community engagement. And so I don't know if that's necessarily going to be a bad world where we make work smarter, no longer misery making, no longer all about overflowing inboxes. People can distribute across the country. They can be in your family. They can be in your outdoors. They can be in your places that otherwise speak to them. And people can use that newfound time to strengthen community engagements, to fill that social psychological hole. I think you do that. And companies, by the way, are more efficient. You can now tap a labor pool that's national as opposed to concentrated in a geographic area, which is very expensive. You don't have to have $1 million median home price in San Francisco anymore because you don't have to have everyone living in San Francisco who works at one of these companies. And so companies can be more efficient. They can have smaller offices. I see a utopian vision here. I don't know if we'll get there, but it is possible. And it looks different than what Jack Mills thought about in the 1970s. But I do think there is a utopian possibility for the 2020s in which everyone ends up a little bit better off.
So I guess the big question is, and finally, did all of this remote work that we've been forced into, this forced experiment, did it alter the culture, do you think, in the end? Did it force us to experience something new? And now will it make us ready to do something more long-lasting?
This is what I'm trying to observe. And so I'm hearing some reports, you know, coming back from companies where it was chaos for 2 months. Now it's slightly less chaos. I mean, next month will be slightly less more. That's probably the sound of some processes being put in place, some taming of the sort of haphazardness of knowledge work starting to happen. I don't know if all companies are going to be as successful as this as others. It's too early right now. I mean, again, look at Paul David. It takes a while to figure these things out. We're being forced into it, but it still takes a while. So it's too early to find out right now if we're going to succeed, but I see hints that we're starting to move in the right direction.
Cal Newport, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Doug.
Cal Newport, he's a professor of computer science at Georgetown University. You can find a link to his New Yorker article, Why Remote Work is So Hard and How It Can Be Fixed, on our website, RadioWest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, @RadioWest. Our intern is Natu Tway. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.